I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. Mark Zuckerberg posted an article on the Facebook newsroom page last month with the headline, "Is Connectivity a Human Right?" In it, he outlined something he called a rough proposal to connect the 5 billion people who are not online with a third of the world that is. He said the goal of his project, called Internet.org, would tackle and overcome the barriers in developing countries to connect and join the knowledge economy. This is just the latest idea to come out of Silicon Valley about using Internet technology to tackle global poverty. Not everyone is impressed. Joining us are Charles Kenny and Justin Sandifer. They're both senior fellows at the Center for Global Development and both are authors of a recent article in Foreign Policy magazine titled, "Can Silicon Valley Save the World?" Charles Kenny, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
And Justin Sandifer, nice to have you with us as well.
Yeah, thank you.
You're welcome. And I should say to our listeners, joining us from the studios of the Christian Science Monitor in Washington, D.C. Charles Kenny, let me begin with you and actually begin with Mark Zuckerberg. Whether it solves global poverty or not, is it a worthy goal to get more people on the Internet?
It's proven to be a really powerful tool for development in lots of different ways. Not just the Internet, but mobile phones, radio, TV, all of these communications technologies have a big role. So if you look at the mobile phone, people are using that technology not just to call friends and family, but also to get jobs, to find out where they should land their fish catch to get the biggest price. And we've seen all sorts of different and innovative uses, and indeed in some ways much more innovative than in the United States. So in Kenya, lots of people are doing mobile banking online, many more than in the United States. At the same time, I think there are many priorities and things that we'd want for desperately poor people in the developing world. One thing is we want them to be alive to enjoy the benefits of technology, and lots of them are dying of really easily preventable diseases. So, yes, sure, connectivity is great, but I guess the point is if you have a limited budget and you're thinking how do we spend money to best improve the lives of the poor, it may not be that broadband internet is where you go first.
Well, I want to pick up on all the things that you just said there, Charles Kenny. Let me get you in on the conversation, Justin Sandifer. But do you believe, as Zuckerberg seems to believe, that the connectivity is a human right? Do you think it's helpful to think of it in those terms?
I'm not sure that's terribly helpful, and it does seem to be a little bit mischievous here. Very convenient for the CEO of a tech firm to believe that connectivity is a human right. So
good for Facebook, you're saying, right?
It's good for Facebook, and I think that raises one of the real ambiguities about this new proposal from Facebook. It's unclear so far to what extent this is an altruistic initiative of corporate social responsibility, and to what extent this is an attempt to penetrate new markets. Facebook is obviously reaching pretty high market saturation in North America and Europe. It's looking for new shores. Rural Latin America or sub-Saharan Africa might be those shores, and so opening up connectivity in those places is one way to expand your market. I don't think that this is necessarily a bad thing if it's a pure business enterprise, or that it's a better thing if it's pure altruism, but it does change the way we think about it and how we should measure its effects and so on.
Well, what was one of the things interesting about your article is the fact that Silicon Valley seems to have discovered and wants to tackle poverty in all its forms. Should we be surprised by that, Charles Kenny?
No, I think I do think it's largely driven by the by good motives. Here are a bunch of people who've made a huge amount of money and been very successful in tech in the United States, and they want to do something with that money. And it's great that they think tackling global poverty should be one of the things they do. And I think they're absolutely right that there's a huge role for technology in improving the lives of everybody worldwide, perhaps especially even the very poorest people on the planet. So I'm not surprised, and I'm very happy. It's just I think both of us would want a bit of caution in how they go about it and what they think they can achieve.
Well, and picking up on something that you wrote in this piece, and I'll toss this to you, Justin Sandifer, which is that a lot of the technology, I guess, that comes out of Silicon Valley or out of the developed world, most technologies were invented in the rich world to solve rich world problems. Can you expand on that?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's the big disconnect when very bright and very successful people in Silicon Valley try to, you know, cross the street and start doing innovative work in philanthropy and in global development. You know, these have been really successful entrepreneurs who've come up with great ideas, but they came up with these ideas in the context of a very competitive marketplace in Silicon Valley. And that competitive marketplace was weeding out the ideas that, you know, customers in the United States and in rich countries didn't feel they needed, and was promoting the ideas that people were willing to pay for. And so the good ideas rise to the top. These bright and successful people are then, you know, taking their success and moving into global development. And as Charles just said, you know, bless them for doing that. I think that's a great instinct. But they are now working in a sector where they really lack that market feedback. They've got, you know, billions or at least millions to play with, and they've got altruistic motives. But they've got some good ideas, and they've got, you know, some duds. And it's not clear that there's anybody telling them which ideas are really in demand and which ideas aren't. And that's, I think, the missing ingredient in a lot of global development work is that feedback mechanism for what's a good idea and what isn't.
But, Justin, are you saying that they don't understand what poverty is?
I'm not sure I would go that far. I'm not criticizing anybody for not empathizing with the problems of the poor. It's not about that. It's about having a system in place to find out what works and to expand the successful things and to kind of pull back on the less successful things. You know, that's what the marketplace does. That's what your investors do for you in a tech startup. And sometimes that's missing in a philanthropic endeavor.
Well, let me quote something else from your article. I'll toss it to you, Charles Kenny. The entrepreneurial spirit and even the fanciest of gadgets will only get you so far. All the technological transformation of the last 200 years hasn't come close to wiping out global poverty. You talk about the importance that, for instance, vaccines have played, but nonetheless, we've got billions of people that are still basically living a subsistence level.
Yeah, so technology has spread worldwide and has done some wonderful things. I mean, you can be caught in a traffic jam in Kabul, for example, and that's a sign that there are a lot of cars there with the technology of internal combustion engine inside it. So we have seen the spread of technology, and it has made a difference to the quality of life of the poor. You mentioned vaccines. Right. You know, every year, millions of children who would have died 20, 30 years ago with the extent of vaccine coverage we have then, millions of those children survive. Now, that's, you know, parents not suffering this unimaginable loss. It's, you know, kids going on to be able to have a fulfilling life. And that's thanks to the technology of the vaccine. So the spread of these technologies has made a real difference to the quality of life. And yet, you know, take a place in Central African Republic, as it might be, where you are actually seeing vaccines spreading to the majority of the population. You know, even despite these technologies spreading, Democratic Republic of the Congo, to the best measures we have, is, you know, pretty much as poor as Gaul in the time of Caesar, you know, 2,000 years ago. So there's a technology has a big role to play, but alone, you know, even the fanciest whiz-bang gadget is not going to turn the Democratic Republic of the Congo into Philadelphia.
Well, Justin, one of the technologies that you write about was that one laptop per child. And I remember a couple of years ago when that really cute little computer was being promoted as a way to help children around the world have access to the Internet. You really describe it as essentially a failure.
Yeah, I think, sadly, that's probably what the best research has shown. But I think we should start off with why this was such a promising idea. We have really a global learning crisis worldwide. We have spent the last couple of decades in the global development industry focused on getting more kids into school. And we've made incredible gains on getting, you know, pushing towards universal primary education. It's been a big human achievement of the last quarter century. But, you know, more research in the last several years is showing that kids entering school in low-income countries are sitting through basically 8 years of primary education, coming out the other end, unable to read, unable to do basic math, unable to handle money and, you know, basically hold a decent job. And so we're putting kids in school and they're not learning anything. And with the advent of cheap computing technology, it seems like a great opportunity to use that technology to put a good curriculum, to put good pedagogical methods in their hands and kind of level the playing field. So I think it was a really exciting idea and a lot of energy and a lot of money put into it. But this is a great example of where you need not just a great idea and a lot of entrepreneurship, but you need, you know, some proof and some feedback as to find out what's working and what's not. And so we've had now, after all of this enthusiasm, two very rigorously done studies and randomized trials comparing schools that got the one laptop per child in Peru and in Nepal with schools that didn't participate. And at the end of the day, what we see is really very little or no gain in reading scores, math scores, school attendance. We're not seeing big gains from this technology.
And Charles Kenny, is that example of something that sounded so good and certainly sounded so promising on paper, but in practice just wasn't used the way it was intended? Why this disconnect?
Well, I mean, especially when it comes to computers, think about how most of us, including me, use computers. A lot of what we use them for, you wouldn't necessarily expect to lead to better learning, better math skills. When people, for instance, in the United States get access to broadband, better internet, what do they use it for? Well, they use it for streaming videos and they use it for downloading music, and some of them go on, adult entertainment sites and so on and so forth. They use it more for a bunch of stuff that's very valuable to them and creates great entertainment, but isn't necessarily going to lead to higher test scores when it comes to their ability to do long division. I mean, it shouldn't come as a surprise that when you give anybody a computer, a lot of what they use it for isn't going to increase their productivity. And so it turns out that computers can play a valuable role in school, but in order for them to do so, you need a teacher that really understands the technology and understands how to use the computer in a classroom setting and encourage the kids to use it in a particular way. And the sad fact of the matter is that in many parts of the world, including the United States, many teachers just aren't equipped to do that. And it's not a failing of the teacher. It can be a failing of the system that they're not getting the adequate training they need. Or it can be a failing of a syllabus that the computer isn't integrated enough into the classroom. So it turns out that the technology can be a terribly powerful tool, but alone, it isn't necessarily a terribly powerful tool. It takes a lot more than just the technology to make a difference.
Well, and we're about 45 seconds from our break here, but if we want to tackle global poverty, and I'll toss this quickly to you, Charles, then is it a matter of focusing smartly on things like education and things like healthcare? I mean, if we should sort of boil it down to two areas, are those the two areas we should focus on?
I think those are two great areas, but especially in 45 seconds, I think there is just no simple answer to global development. And what we need to do is experiment, experiment, and experiment again.
Well, we have much more time after this very short break, more than 45 seconds. That's Charles Kenny, who joins us along with Justin Sandifer, and they are both senior fellows at the Center for Global Development and co-authors of an article last month in Foreign Policy magazine titled, Can Silicon Valley Save the World? And we're talking about technology. We certainly began with our conversation talking a bit about Facebook's Mark Zuckerberg trying to bring the internet to 5 billion people in the developing world. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Questions or comments, give us a call. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Fringe Art supports WHYY and presents the 2013 Fringe Festival September 5th through 22nd, featuring over 150 local and international theater, dance, music, and visual art events in venues across Philadelphia. Spotlight shows include Where We Live by So Percussion, a multi-sensory concert that coaxes music from the work of guest artisans like a violin maker, a metal worker, and a brewmaster who join musicians, dance, theater, and video artists on stage. Tickets at fringearts.com.
Next time in Studio 360.
There's the camera, and this one says, be a beautiful girl. Do you want to be a beautiful girl?
I do. I've always wanted to be a beautiful girl.
Okay.
We burrow deep into contemporary Japan.
I'm excited.
A Japanese makeover for me. Next time in
Studio 360 with Carl Anderson.
From PRI and WNYC.
Tonight at 10 on WHYY.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. Next time on Here and Now, why did the daughter of the detective behind San Francisco's Trailside serial killer case visit the killer years later on death row?
I certainly was hoping to learn something about my father, and I did have a secret desire to get a confession out of him.
That's next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane. Facebook's Mark Zuckerberg said he's trying to bring the Internet to 5 billion people in the developing world. He hopes his new initiative called Internet.org will address poverty and economic disparity. But can web access really help the world's poor? We're talking with Charles Kenny and Justin Sandifer, and again, taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Why? Justin, we're talking about all the things that you both say haven't worked, but let me focus on something else. And I guess an idea sort of like the one laptop for all, something called the socket. Can you describe what that is? Go ahead.
So the socket is another idea which had a lot of promise, really creative solution. And that is, as the name implies, it involves soccer and electricity. Much of the developing world lacks access to on-grid power provision. People need electricity. And so really clever engineering students coming out of Harvard developed this soccer ball that can, after kicking it around for 30 minutes, can power an LED light for up to 3 hours. So you basically harness the power of play to create electricity that can light up your home in the evening. Really creative, really cool, an incredible engineering feat to get this electricity generator inside of a regulation soccer ball.
Did it work?
Yeah,
go ahead.
Yeah, well, it works. I mean, it literally works. It creates light. And, Bill Clinton has praised this, and lots of people have gotten really excited about this. The problem is the thing costs about $100. And if you're talking about marketing a solution to the poorest corners of the world, that's just, a really unattainable price. You can get an equivalent light, solar powered, for about a tenth that cost. Hmm. And so it's really unclear why you want to rely on making your kids kick around the soccer ball all day to power your lights when you can do the same thing with solar energy much more cheaply. It's a really creative idea that just lacked kind of practicality.
Do you want to weigh in on that, Charles Kenny?
Yeah, well, I mean, and one of the sad things about President Obama's recent visit to Africa, frankly, was that the technology that he sort of chose to play around with was the socket. That's despite the fact that the USAID, the USAID agency, is actually doing some really creative things, trying to weed out good technologies and bad and test them, in the settings where they're meant to be working. And so, rather than focusing on some great ideas that are coming out of his own aid agency, the president decided to go with this thing that looks cool on TV, but probably doesn't actually have too much potential to really change the lives of the poorest worldwide.
So, what would Charles Kenny?
Well, I mean, one of the things, as Justin mentioned, solar powered lighting is spreading worldwide, and the reason is that it's it is cheap. You can get these lamps for $10. You stick them out in the sun all day, and then they light up the room at night. They're cheap. They're robust. They're effective. You don't need fuel. And for people who have been using candles or firelight or kerosene lamps, which are dangerous, if you sit in a room with a kerosene lamp going all night, it's like smoking two packs of cigarettes. They're really not nice things. So moving from that to solar lanterns really makes a difference. And USAID, through its development innovations program DIV, is actually supporting the rollout of solar lamps across Africa through something called Solar Sister, which is a sort of a women's cooperative movement, effectively, that buys these lamps and sells them on in markets across East Africa. And that's a powerful, sustainable approach to really answering some of the energy needs of the very poorest people in Africa, and is really cool. And is being and we know it works, or at least so far we know it works, because it's being tested as part of USAID support. They say, you must test this approach. You must see if actually people are using this technology. And in the long term for Solar Sister, they're saying, we're not going to support this forever. This is a technology that if poor people want, poor people should be, showing they want it by buying it. So we'll support your startup costs, but then we're leaving you to it to expand the model. So you know, back to what was Justin was saying earlier about the market test, the ultimate test for whether the solar system will work is going to be the market test. Will poor people buy this technology?
And I guess the difference between the, maybe even the PR difference between Socket and the way that can be promoted and a $10 solar light is pretty dramatic, Justin, right? I mean, is that part of the problem, is that smart people have kind of fallen in love with a certain idea? It's very creative on paper, but sort of doesn't make sense when you apply it in the real world?
I think that is a big part of it. I mean, it's really hard for President Obama to bounce a solar cell on his head when he goes to Tanzania, but the soccer ball works pretty well. It's a great photo op. And it's sad to see, you know, people get, you know, drawn in just by that kind of attractiveness in a photo op. But there are alternative ways of testing the effectiveness of things. And I think, you know, as Charles mentioned, the U.S. Agency for International Development is making big strides. There are researchers at MIT and Harvard and other universities working with the U.S. government to go out and test things systematically in the field to see what works, to see what improves people's lives. And so there are ways of testing more sustainable solutions and not just suckering for a cool new gadget.
But, you know, this reminds me of the conversations we have about how to improve education, and everyone's always talking about what we can do in order to help people learn better, including students, youngsters in this country. Do we not know, Charles Kenny, about how to get more poor people into the world of the middle class and maybe even beyond?
Well, we know that it can happen, right? I mean, if you look at the spectacular growth in China over the last 30 years, that's brought more people out of global poverty than any other single event in human history. So we know that it can happen, but you know, take the example of China. People argue a lot over what was behind that, including about, you know, how big was the role of technology, or was it all investment? Was it education? So there's a lot of disagreement. And it's probably rather context specific. What worked in China in 1980 may not work in Kenya in 2010. And this comes back to sort of a central theme of the article, and I think, you know, what we're advocating. It's not that there isn't a role for technology. There's a big role for technology. It's not that there isn't a role for education. There's a big role for education. But in order to figure out how to get the education right and how to get the technology right, you have to keep on experimenting and learning from both your failures and your successes. You've got to make sure that you monitor your intervention and see whether it works in a particular setting or not. And then if it works in that setting, try it in another setting, but monitor again and see if it works, rather than just saying, oh, well, this is a cool idea. Let's put a lot of money behind this. So it's, you know, what we're really calling for here is much more experimentation and learning about not just the role of technology, but, you know, other interventions to improve the quality of life worldwide.
And what I hear you both saying, Justin, is doing rigorous research and then sharing that research, so that while something that might work in China might not work in Uganda, at least we have some of the research that we can base whatever we do on.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think you've sort of got two paths to showing that your idea has traction and is worth funding. For a lot of things, the market test is probably the best test. If you want to sell a solution to, lighting in the developing world, well, as Solar Sister is doing, as Charles referenced, is to market this to people. If people are willing to pay for this, that's great. You know, it survives the market test after a little bit of initial, venture funding. Then great, roll that out. The other alternative, though, there's lots of things that we think are important for global development in education and in health that people can't afford to pay for, but we still think are worth investing in with public finance. And to do that, you know, the problem gets a lot trickier, and that's where I think the role of researchers really comes in and is really vital, is rigorous research to show what's working and what's not working with, you know, it's the same sort of approach that's been used for decades in clinical trials in medicine, and the same thing is being more and more widely used to design good development programs. Try it out, experiment with it, and have a control group so you can see what is the relevant benchmark, what is, you know, the counterfactual, what would have happened if I hadn't done this here. And by doing that, you can really identify effective programs in development.
And not nearly as exciting as a socket, right, Justin?
Yeah, maybe not, but I think, there's a...
I'm not denigrating it. I'm just saying in terms of getting people interested and excited, right?
Yeah, but certainly not. It's not as exciting as a socket. You know, you can't play with it. But you know, there's a new crop of young people coming up in the development and the aid industry who are being raised on this kind of rigorous testing, who are, you know, cutting their teeth doing field work in sub-Saharan Africa, running randomized trials. And I think it's bringing a new degree of rigor and evidence base to the philanthropic industry that we haven't had in the past. So it's a really exciting time right now in the industry.
And that's Justin Sandifer, who joins us along with Charles Kenny, in fact, joining us from the studios of the Christian Science Monitor in Washington, D.C. They're both senior fellows at the Center for Global Development and co-authors of an article that came out just last month in Foreign Policy magazine. It was titled, Can Silicon Valley Save the World? And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Charles Kenny, I was interested in how much pushback Mark Zuckerberg got, including pushback from Bill Gates on Zuckerberg's idea of trying to get everybody connected online. Do you think that pushback was just because it's Mark Zuckerberg and Facebook and we should all be very suspicious?
I would point out, of course, that you know, Mark Zuckerberg is saying that the internet is a solution to global poverty, and he's in the internet business. And
yes,
of course, we're saying research is the answer to global poverty, and we're in the research business. So perhaps you know you should discount both.
Yes, but he's a lot richer than you are. I'm assuming
that's true. I think that's safe to say. Yes. But you know, Bill Gates, who's certainly up there with Mark Zuckerberg and rich. I don't think it's a case of him sort of stomping on the idea just because it comes from the owner of Facebook. He's long before Zuckerberg came out with this proposal. Bill Gates has been on record saying that, you know, he thinks the internet is a wonderful technology, but the internet does not help you deal with a child who's got you know, constant diarrhea and is becoming you know, very sick from it. It doesn't directly help you vaccinate a child, although there are definitely roles for the internet sort of in the background in helping vaccination programs get more efficient. So I think Gates's line is that this is a powerful technology, but the idea that if you had sort of one technology that you could roll out and give to everybody, it probably wouldn't be the internet first. And I think I'd agree with that, that there are other technologies that I'd rather see go universal first. I mean, in fact, you know, even when it comes to communications technologies, the mobile phone, you know, we've already got something like 6 billion subscribers worldwide. We're getting awfully close to universal mobile phone coverage. And if we could get just sort of basic mobile, including nowadays that comes along with sort of basic internet access, I think that's probably a more appropriate technology for the poor. And we know that because, you know, if 6 billion subscribers out there, a lot of poor people have already taken some of their very meager income and are using it to get a mobile phone subscription. So we've already, you know, passed the market test with that one. It clearly is a powerful tool to improve the quality of life of poor people. So I'd sort of start there rather than necessarily with, you know, trying to go direct to broadband or higher bandwidth internet. And, you know, maybe all of those mobile phones won't be able to use Facebook, but if they can even just use mobile banking and you know, provide texting services and so on, that can make a really noticeable difference to the quality of life of people worldwide.
Well, Justin, even picking up on what Bill Gates said, you know, when you're dying of malaria, I suppose you'll look up and see the balloon. He's talking about the Google balloon. I'm not sure how it will help you, but it should, I think, also be said that not everyone in a poor country is poor. I mean, that there are people in poor countries who are middle class and probably very entrepreneurial themselves.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's a demand for connectivity and there's a demand for internet access. And, you know, applause to Zuckerberg if he thinks he can help meet that demand. You know, the problem, I take Bill Gates' point that, you know, there's a lot of gains to be made in preventing diseases like malaria. And it seems that we can do this for a few cents for, you know, bed nets or, you know, diarrhea prevented with clean water. But there's more to solving these problems than just a lack of money. And these problems are not intractable, but they are complicated. Mm. And it's not obvious to me that Mark Zuckerberg is the guy to fix them. Mark Zuckerberg might be the guy to help expand internet connectivity. And so if he can do that, then more power to him. I would shift gears, though, maybe, and focus on one area where Mark Zuckerberg and Bill Gates are on the same page entirely, and where the entire kind of tech industry in Silicon Valley has rallied around together on an issue of global development. And that is the need for immigration reform in the United States. And this is a big development issue that the tech industry has gotten behind. This alliance called Forward.us, FWD.us, you can find it online. So Bill Gates is there, Mark Zuckerberg has signed on, founders of LinkedIn, YouTube, Dropbox are all behind this idea that the United States needs to reform its immigration policies. We need the best and the brightest from the developing world, from India and so on, software engineers, to come power our tech industry. And this has huge implications for kind of economic opportunity of people in developing countries. And, you know, there's no Microsoft or Google or Facebook conflict here. They're all in agreement. We just need Congress to do something about it.
Let me get Iban from Brooklyn to join our conversation. Iban, go ahead. You're on Radio Times. Hi, go ahead. You're on the air.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
Nice to have you here. Go ahead.
I think it's an exciting topic. I think that one of your speakers, although he means well, he reminds me of classmates of mine at MIT. he wants all the fun to be in the hands of the engineers, and who can blame him? But it is very extraordinary to actually miss the elephant in the room, which is if you have a soccer ball, sorry to go back to that, but you have a soccer ball that generates power at night, the point is not that the technology costs too much. The point is that it's inspirational, and you get everybody involved. You get the designers, the artists, the first world, the third world, if we can still use that term. And if it were up to the engineers with their vigorous testing, everybody would be so bored, nothing would get done. And I think he's missing a much larger dynamic. And so things tend to be solved in a kind of a scurrying, like probing and interaction between different groups of people. And so he spent a little bit too much time in the lab and needs to get out. Williamsburg, Brooklyn was
Iban,
this kind of everyone involved dynamic.
Sure, no, I think you raise a really good point, and I'm not sure which one to toss to. Again, about a minute before our second break here. Charles Kenny, can I toss that first to you?
Sure. First of all, my wife was an engineer at MIT, so of course I want them to have lots of fun. I would say that absolutely this is an area where everybody needs to be involved. Engineers certainly don't have all the answers. Economists certainly don't have all the answers. This needs to be a team game. I would say one of the things I find most exciting is the idea of fewer kids dying of easily preventable diseases. Saving the misery of those parents seems to me one of the most exciting things one can do. Testing approaches to make sure that they work and are a good expenditure of limited resources is a powerful way to do that. And so for all it may sound a bit boring because it's math, I think it is vitally important.
Well, and Justin, I mean, if kids naturally around the world play soccer, so why not use that energy?
Absolutely. I hope we can find a way of using that energy in a cost-effective way. What I don't think we should do is spend $100 per soccer ball when we could spend a tenth as much to achieve the same outcome.
And you could buy them a $10 soccer ball.
There's $20 there. Well, Iman, I do appreciate the call to Radio Times. We do need to take a very short break and then get back to our conversation. Talking with Justin Sandifer and Charles Kenny, and we read their article in last month's edition of Foreign Policy Magazine, caught our eye, titled Can Silicon Valley Save the World? And that's what we're talking about in this hour of Radio Times. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-9499. WHYY. Stay with us. Call us. We'll be right back.
Lodge Lane Assisted Living supports WHYY. Lodge Lane is offering tours of their newly opened community located in North Wilmington, Delaware. Guided by time-honored Jewish traditions and values, Lodge Lane welcomes residents of all faiths in a supportive, friendly environment with round-the-clock staffing to assist with daily tasks. They offer a variety of floor plan styles and amenities that include kosher and non-kosher dining, multiple gathering places, and a secure memory care neighborhood. 302-757-8100 or lodgelane.org.
Composer John Zorn, who just turned 60, has been called an all-purpose impresario of the avant-garde and among contemporary music's most prolific and wide-ranging achievers. He rarely gives interviews, but we'll talk with him on the next Fresh Air. Also, we hear about Apple's new mobile operating system for the iPhone and iPad. Join us. this afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
Advice and consent on Syria.
No way do we go into Syria. If Assad is truly guilty of using chemical weapons, go to The Hague and lead the effort to have him indicted as a war criminal.
Does congressional authorization strengthen the president's hand or limit his options? Be a part of the debate next time on The Takeaway from PRI, Public Radio International.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoe, talking with Charles Kenny and Justin Sandifer, senior fellows at the Center for Global Development, co-authors of an article in Foreign Policy magazine titled "Can Silicon Valley Save the World?" That article caught our eye. Is also the fact that Facebook's Mark Zuckerberg just announced the launch of something called Internet.org, his grand vision to bring the internet to the billions of people who are without internet right now. His goal is to give everyone, he says, in the developing world, access to the knowledge-based economy. We're talking about the role of technology, the limits of technology to reduce global poverty, and we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Justin, both you and Charles mentioned a small program in the State Department, which is doing, I guess, some of this research, looking at what works and what doesn't work. How small is this program, and it's within AID, is that right?
That's right. So this is a unit called Development Innovation Ventures, which, as the name implies, is setting out to fund basically experimental new initiatives with kind of a venture capital model that will contribute to development. It's small. It's, I think, around, I might get the numbers wrong here, I think it's around $70 million so far, but the British government has just signed on, actually, to expand this as kind of a joint effort that the U.S. will lead, that the British will contribute to. But what's exciting is the centrality here of testing and experimentation and research. It's not just, you know, we've tried this microfinance model in 32 countries and it seems to be running okay and we don't know what we're achieving. It's, no, let's try something new and let's put real testing behind it and see if we're improving people's incomes and if we're lifting people out of poverty or not, and really identifying which programs are successful. So this is, you know, this is with collaboration from researchers from top universities. Michael Kramer from Harvard has taken time off from Harvard University to help lead this. You've got kind of the best minds in development research working with the U.S. Agency for International Development to come up with new ideas.
Well, and one of the studies that you write about, Charles Kenny, has to do with a minibus problem in Kenya. Can you talk a bit about that?
Yeah, I think this is a really nice example because it shows that, you know, innovation doesn't have to be about smart new techs. It can actually be fairly low tech and make a huge difference. So the program is a wonderful one, dealing with a very, very serious problem. You know, millions of people in the developing world die in road accidents. You know, it's far more dangerous driving in the developing world than it is in rich countries. In particular, driving in large public taxis, matatus, can be a harrowing experience. I speak from experience myself. You know, they drive very badly and they crash a lot and lots of people die. Lots of pedestrians die, but also you know, people in their cars die. The innovation that DIV financed the testing of was a really simple innovation. It was to put a little sticker in the back of the car saying, you know, if you're worried about your driver and how he's driving, complain. And just putting that sticker in the back of the car, people started complaining a lot more about bad driving. And the driving got better, and we know the driving got better because they put stickers in some cars and they didn't in others, sort of you know, randomly chose some cars to put them in and didn't put those stickers in others. And the cars with the stickers in it saw 60% fewer insurance claims involving injury or death. So, you know, a really dramatic drop-off in the number of people that these matatus were running over and the number of cases of matatus being involved in crashes. Just putting this sticker in the back of the car. Now, talk about sustainability. Of course, the insurance agency took one look at this result and said, right, you know, we're demanding that anybody who gets insurance from us sticks a sticker like this in the back of the car. And it's, you know, sort of gone nationwide. So, you know, a really simple intervention coupled with really accurate, rigorous testing approach led to a really dramatic decline in fatalities in Kenya. So, you know, a huge result from something incredibly simple. And that's the kind of thing that, you know, when you combine innovative ideas, you know, the kind of thing that Silicon Valley is great at, coming up with completely new ways of doing things, when you combine that with rigorous testing, you can get these fantastic results.
And where did that idea, whose idea was that? Do you know, Charles?
Justin, do you know the original idea?
The original idea of making these bumper stickers, I'm not sure, but it's two researchers from Georgetown University who did this, you know, and a pilot in their own kind of small-scale university research project, Billy Jack and James Habyarimana at Georgetown here in D.C., and they had some initial successes piloting it, and so they went to USAID and said, look, we've got this seemingly trivial idea that seems to be saving people's lives. Will you give us a grant to pilot this at a little bit larger scale? And they did, and it's sort of taken off from there.
I mean, I ask because sometimes the criticism of people trying to solve global poverty is that they are, you know, they don't live where they're talking about and have a kind of disconnect from the people that they are studying. The idea, did this idea come from Kenyans or did it come from people at MIT?
I don't know in this case. I mean, I would agree with your basic surmise that quite often the very best ideas do come from the developing world. And I mean, the mobile phone is full of cases like this. I mean, texting really didn't pick up in the United States or Europe. It was in the Philippines in particular. Right. People realized that sending a text costs a cent or two. Well, if you were a very poor person, the difference between, you know, a cent or two for a text and 20, 30 cents for a short phone call is big news. And so it's the Philippines where we really saw the global texting revolution take off, if you will. And it's Kenya where we're seeing the global mobile banking revolution take off, again, because, you know, there are only a couple of hundred banks in the entire country. There's a much greater need for other ways to do finance than there is in the United States or Europe. And so, you know, it was people in these local communities who are coming up with the great and innovative ways to use these technologies. And I think that, you know, that is quite often the case, absolutely.
Well, but it sounds like if there's a piece of technology to talk about that has been successful, Justin, it is the mobile phone.
I think it's there's a lot of ways to judge that, and I wouldn't make any grandiose sweeping statements about whether the mobile phones are going to lead to global development. But there are specific cases where we see big gains. Just to go to another kind of pilot project that DIV is looking at, there's been a lot of hype around the idea that mobile phones are going to revolutionize healthcare in the developing world. That, you know, rural areas you can get mobile phone service where you don't have skilled doctors and so on. But there hasn't been, you know, a lot of proof behind this and a lot of, you know, real evidence that this is making a difference. And so what we're starting to see now with DIV support, experimental work being done in Tanzania and India with, you know, developing a simple mobile phone app that can run on, like, you know, your basic Nokia phone. You don't need a smartphone. You just need text. Mm-hmm. And so instead of needing skilled doctors in the field, what you have are young women who are, you know, basically literate, who have maybe secondary education at the most. They work in the villages where they're from, and they get instructions by mobile phone about, you know, how to do diagnosis and what the right protocols are for, you know, treating malaria or treating diarrhea and so on. And, you know, what we're seeing are big improvements in the timeliness of their visits and adherence to WH protocols with just the prompting they're getting from these mobile phone-based health apps. So that's it's a cool example. It's spreading out to 750,000 villages across India. The government's gotten behind it. It's a cool example that seems to be bearing fruit. Mm. But, you know, the next example, the next app might not work. And I don't think we want to just conclude that mobile phones are going to solve the problem. We need evidence on a case-by-case basis like this.
Well, and that reminds me, Charles Kenny, of shows we've done about this country and our healthcare system and the issue of compliance and how, in many ways, how uncompliant people are and how that has healthcare and health costs implications.
Yeah, I think that's true. That in the developing world, as much as the rich world, people don't always do what's good for them. And mobile phones are being used to sort of send out text messages prompting people to take their antiretroviral medicines, for HIV or their TB medicines to fight TB. So there is a role for mobile phones there, but they certainly, as Justin's suggesting, they certainly aren't. Here we have it, the solution to all development problems. But one of the nice things we are seeing in the developing world is changing norms about health. And this isn't really so much a technology story as it is just, a story of ideas changing. I mean, washing hands is just becoming a much more normal thing worldwide. And indeed, if you look at demand for vaccination programs in the developing world, that's rising too. More and more parents are realizing it's vitally important to get their kids vaccinated. Note in the United States and Europe, the trend is the other way. We've seen measles outbreaks in this country because people are selfishly and frankly idiotically choosing not to get their kids vaccinated. And as a result, we're seeing diseases that were pretty much wiped out in this country come back. So, in that way, the developing world is very much on the right track and the rich world is on the wrong track.
And that's Charles Kenny joining us along with Justin Sandifer. We are talking about global poverty and technology and some basic ways to address the issue of global poverty. And again, taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHY. Why? Justin, we do talk about the digital divide, certainly in this country, and I'm assuming, in many ways we are still talking about the digital divide when we look around the world, are we not?
Absolutely. That was the premise behind Mark Zuckerberg's announcement of this new internet.org initiative, is that there are billions of people around the developing world who don't have access to mobile technology, and certainly, particularly problematic for Mark Zuckerberg, they don't have access to streaming data and to smartphones that would allow them to access things like Facebook or just more broadly the internet in general. There's a big question. I think one of the big debates in the research literature has been, the global divide about whether or not the rise of internet technology, mobile technology, is going to bring people together, is going to be a force for kind of convergence for remote areas that don't have physical infrastructure but might be able to leapfrog that step and get on the IT bandwagon, or whether these kinds of new technologies really require a kind of skill base, regular electricity, physical infrastructure in order to work, and that, what we're going to see is more divergence. So, certainly if you look at the development of the tech industry globally, it's a really concentrated industry with a huge pocket of activity in Silicon Valley. That in and of itself, lots of the billions, the tech billionaires are largely, in Northern California and not in the Rift Valley and, in Kenya. So it can cut both ways.
Charles Kenny, as I was preparing for the show, I Wikipedia'd, this name just flew right out of my head. Hold on just one little second here. Oh, Andrew Carnegie, who obviously made lots and lots of money as a business person, and developed universities, and he helped to develop the public library system in this country. Does that in any way connect with what we've been talking about just 100 years ago?
I think you're right. There are parallels. There was a time when we saw the public library as, the killer app for global education,
if you
will. And libraries have played a hugely valuable role in society. I don't mean to downplay that, but a library alone does not create a fully informed, completely literate and numerate society. Sadly, it takes more than that. They have a role, but it takes more than that. And it speaks to the fact that we've got sort of multiple divides in development. The thing about developing countries is they're poorer and they have a lower quality of life. That's kind of why we call them developing countries. So they've, there's a literacy divide. There's an all-weather road divide. There's an electricity divide. All of these divides together are kind of what make poor people poor and more likely to die young and less likely to get a full course of education, and what make rich people richer and more likely to be educated and live in safer communities and so on. And so overcoming any one of these divides is going to have knock-on effects in other areas, and I certainly don't want to suggest that the internet couldn't play a role, reducing the digital divide couldn't play a role. But I don't think we want to put all of our eggs, or indeed, you know, a lot of our eggs in that one basket. It has to be part of a broader approach.
And Justin, just to underscore what Charles has said, we're talking about, what, 4 billion people who live on something like $4 a day and or less?
Right. It's really a staggering number. When you think about minimum wages in the United States and how difficult it can be to make ends meet on that kind of money. And then you're looking at a lot of countries where, you know, the absolute poverty line that the World Bank uses is $1.25 a day, actually. And that's adjusted for local price differences. So you're talking about, you know, purchasing power of $1.25 a day. In the poorest countries, you still have a majority of the population living on less than that. So we do, there is a point to be made here about, not to sound trite, but about the hierarchy of needs. These are people who spend a majority of their income on basic foodstuffs, and agricultural productivity is a primary concern. If we can find a way to muster IT and new technology to improve that, then great. But we're starting from a very low level.
But should we be depressed when we look into the future, Justin, about at least tackling, if not helping to solve, some of the problems of global poverty? And I hate to do this. Another 45 seconds for your answer. Go ahead.
I don't think we should be depressed. Just focusing on sub-Saharan Africa, where you get really high incidence of income poverty, has really economically begun to turn a corner in the last decade. Economic growth rates in sub-Saharan Africa have really accelerated in the last 10 years relative to the previous two decades. So there is hope that sustained economic growth of this sort could begin to put a real dent in that number of people living in absolute poverty.
Do you agree with that, Charles?
Absolutely. I'm hugely optimistic for the future.
Well, on that happy note, my thanks to both of you for joining us today in Radio Times. Charles Kenny and Justin Sandiford, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. And both senior fellows at the Center for Global Development, and we've been talking about an article they wrote for Foreign Policy magazine titled "Can Silicon Valley Save the World?" And they joined us from the studios of the Christian Science Monitor in Washington, D.C. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can find out much more about this program. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thank you so much for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times, and stay with us. We'll be right back.